Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And a very good morning across San Antonio, the Hill Country, South Texas, wherever you happen to be listening. Wasn't it a beautiful day yesterday? Well, guess what? You got another one on tap for today. It's going to be a very comfortable temperature to get out and work outside. And all we need is some more rain, at least around certain parts of the area. I know some of you guys got a really good rain last week, but some of us kind of on the dry end. But the weather, well, other than the lack of rain, you sure can't beat the temperatures. And so many things to do in the garden, whether it's flower gardening or vegetable gardening or working with your house plants for all those good things. That's what we're here to talk about. My first three callers are going to be Ron and AJ and LaWanda. You dial quickly, you just might be number four. I hate to keep people waiting, so gosh, so much to talk about, but let's get started with your questions. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Bob. After you and Howard Garrett talked about the eclipse, I had to call in.
Okay.
I'm the guy with the ranch. I'm the guy with the ranch between Lake and Camp Wood.
Uh-huh.
It's about 315 acres. We're almost in the dead center of the eclipse, and we were also in the center of the annual eclipse, the only place in the country those two cross. But anyway, it was kind of like it was around everywhere else, slightly light clouds. You could tell they were moving.
Yeah.
And every now and then you'd see a glimpse of the eclipse as it was occurring, and it took place over like an hour.
Right,
but
right.
A friend of ours was there, and she said, I read that when there's a total solar eclipse, the atmosphere cools so rapidly, the clouds separate. And that's exactly what happened. It was almost like divine intervention. We had 4 minutes and twenty-something seconds of solid, total darkness.
And, wow.
And it's just, I think it's the effect of the cooling of the atmosphere that does it.
Well, it's interesting because Howard Garrett had the same thing. Now, where we were sitting and watching it between Bergheim and Kendalia, it stayed overcast the whole time. Every now and then you would get just you know, a tiny little glimpse of it, but the clouds over us got thick and stayed thick. It got dark. It certainly, well, not pitch black dark, but it approached what you would see at least at twilight, and it was really interesting. But somehow we didn't get that view. I'm certainly glad you did.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it was, like I said, it was almost like divine intervention because it was that way the whole time until the eclipse, the total eclipse occurred,
uh-huh.
And then the clouds parted for that period of time, 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes. It was really amazing.
We've had the parting of the waters a couple of thousand years ago. Now we have the parting of the clouds for Ron. I appreciate
knowing that. I don't know if you've ever read an interesting book. It's called The Privileged Planet.
And no, I have not.
One of the writers is an astrophysicist, and they make a big deal about how for an eclipse to occur like we had on Monday, the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun all have to be perfectly aligned, mm-hmm. the right size, the right distance from each other for this to happen. And it's really a pretty interesting book to read about the perfect planet.
I'll look for it. Another interesting thing that I heard was that this eclipse occurred during what they call a supermoon, where the moon is closer and appears larger, and it's the reason that the totality was about 4 minutes instead of about 2 minutes, which is what I saw up in Portland a few years ago when we got to see that eclipse kind of by accident. Had nurserymen's meeting up there and didn't even know the eclipse was going to happen. We were saying, gosh, why is it so hard to get a rent car? Why are hotel rooms so expensive? And somebody said, well, that's because the eclipse day after tomorrow. And so we got to see that one, and it was very interesting. But it only lasted like 2 minutes at totality. So this idea of it's not only the perfect alignment of the sun, the moon, and the earth, but where the moon is in its orbit, because it, you know, goes, it varies as far as its distance, and it's at a closer point, so it appeared larger, and therefore the totality lasted longer for us. So, fascinating thing. My brain's just not big enough to wrap around all this. So we went to the McDonald Observatory down in Big Bend a couple of years ago, and after about 5 minutes, they totally lost me talking about the Doppler shift and all those things. Yeah, it's sure a pretty place. But
and there's a man who called in who explained the shadow effect, or what do you call it, tunnel effect of the leaves. I knew about that. That's also fascinating.
It is, because I remember a previous eclipse at some point before there were eclipse glasses everywhere, and you could see what was happening by punching that hole in a piece of paper and holding it over a second piece of paper, and you got to see the little sun disappearing. But I never would have thought of that as being the reason for the weird shadows. But it was a fascinating event, something that everybody who watched it enjoyed it, and those who know a little more. I was asking the folks around here that were talking, and they said, and I haven't had a chance to do it yet, it's what the astronaut saw of the eclipse, and it's apparently like just a big black spot moving across the Earth in the line where the eclipse was visible. So I haven't had a chance to look at that, but I hear that's very interesting as well.
Well, and just quickly, I know you have other people waiting. The annular eclipse was basically the same thing, except the moon was a little farther away from the Earth.
And that's why we saw the whole sun disappear.
Same, yeah. You know, same positioning, just the moon wasn't in the same place in the orbit. But anyway, I just had to call in and talk because, I'm 81 years old. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience for me. It was almost like you had this spiritual feeling. It's hard to explain it. It was really something.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you doing so, Ron. You get out and have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk again.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
Yes, sir. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Goodbye. AJ's next. Good morning, AJ.
Good morning, Bobby. How are you doing?
Oh, I am just doing very, very well. It's a beautiful spring morning out there.
And no situations on your list of things?
Well, you know, I have a couple of ongoing situations, but when something's a little bit beyond my power to control it, I try to just put it out of my mind. So, no, sir, I'm not situation free, but most everything is looking pretty rosy for the day. How about yourself?
Well, I'm going to tell you what I've done and what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to let you tell me it's all wrong, all right?
Well, we'll decide that after you tell me.
I got that information that you gave me on those rose cuttings.
Right.
I took 36 cuttings, and I wound up with one of them that I figured was going to make it, and that darn thing laid over on me. So we're going to wait till next February now. But I've got gopher sand here in the garden.
Right.
And I plan to plant some portulaca seeds.
Right.
And I've loosened the soil up already, and I know I got to get all the clods out of it. And now I'm going to take some regular dirt and run it through a screen to get it real fine where I can mix the seed with that dirt. And I got some holes punched in some jar lids, and I'm going to apply the seeds that way, you know, that loose soil and that seed together. Now, what do I need to do to that soil to get that stuff to take off?
Basically, I would, you know, I'd work a little bit of dryer fertilizer, the Growing Green or something like that, in, you know, before you're ready to put your seed in. And then basically it's just keep it moist. It's hard sometimes without the right nozzle on your hose. It's hard to water the soil without washing everything away. So if you have or if you can find one of these things called a mist, M-I-S-T, mist nozzle, you screw onto the end of the hose, and it's just almost like a fog coming out. The droplets are so fine. And that's the best way I know of to be able to water without, because those portulaca seeds are not real big. It's the best way I know to water without washing them away. I guess you could always just take a little spray bottle, but you might wear your wrist out trying to moisten it enough. But look around and see if you can find one of the mist nozzles. And I think one of them puts out 3 gallons a minute. One of them puts out 1 gallon a minute. One of them puts out a half gallon a minute. But it is just a very, very fine, just almost like a cloud of water that will moisten things very well without washing anything away.
Okay, now when I apply that on that soil, do I just put it on there and then wet it down right after that, or do I need to do anything else?
No, that's all on earth you need to do. Then just, you
is
know,
that,
keep
that loose soil that seed may go in it just a little bit so it would germinate. All right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, portulaca is not one of those seeds that has to have light. Some seeds actually have to be up on the surface of the soil and have light in order to sprout. Portulaca is not one of those. So, yes, it just the most important thing is don't bury it too deeply, because, you know, it's that little plant's pretty small and it needs to not have too much soil sitting on top of it while it's trying to push its way through. But just keep it bright and warm. Moisten your soil whenever it seems to be drying on the surface. With your, you know, sand, you're probably not going to have any problem with it forming a crust or anything like that, like some folks do. So, no, you're probably going to be watering every day to get it started. Once those little green plants start showing up, just, you know, treat them like you do everything else and water them when they're dry and fertilize them every couple of weeks, and you'll be looking at pretty flowers pretty soon.
Let me ask you another question. See, the morning temperatures here are just getting into the 70s, but then they get into the mid-80s.
Right.
How come I couldn't put those seeds out in the fall? Because I've got portulacas growing in pots in the garden, and they bloom, and then they come up from seeds that are dispersed out while the plant is dead.
Right.
Why couldn't those seeds be put out earlier than now?
Well, if you put them out too early, of course, just even a light frost will kill them. So we have to wait till we're pretty certain we're past a frost, and we've had frost in early April. So that's why I would never plant them in the fall. I guess if you planted early fall, you could enjoy them until it got real chilly, but you'd only have probably a month or two to enjoy the flowers between the time it took it to grow up to blooming size and the time that we'd normally have our first killing frost. You can plant them almost any time, but when we do it this time of year, we're going to have the longest season to enjoy the flowers before they freeze and we have to start over again.
Well, these things have been volunteering in those pots for about 5 years, and they come up, you know, right after the cold season and take off. And so that's why I was wondering why I couldn't put them in earlier. Well, I did put some in February. It had a warm spell, but none of them made it. So I'm going to give it a try again, Bob, and I'm going to let you go and let you make somebody else happy.
Well, let me just tell you one more thing, AJ, and that is that, remember, those seeds are paying attention to the soil temperature, not to the air temperature. And for a lot of this spring, the air temperature has been nice and balmy and good shirt sleeves weather for us. But that soil has stayed pretty cold. The soil has really just started warming up, and that's why they didn't germinate earlier. You know, 75, 82 degrees felt real good to us, but that soil was probably still in the 60s, and those little seeds were sitting there saying, not ready for me to come up. So that's, it's, you know, don't think about how you feel. Think about what the temperature of the soil is, and that way you'll know when the seeds decide to cooperate.
All right, Bob. I'm going to see what kind of luck I get, and I do thank you for your time.
It's always a pleasure, AJ, and we'll talk some more about getting some of those rose cuttings going another time. So you get out and have a good day. I'm going to get a break in here. Thank you, sir, and then we'll talk to LaWanda. Right now, it looks like I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And once again, Fanix is celebrating 85 years in business. That's an awful long time, a lot longer than I've been on this earth and probably you as well. And I believe this is about the fourth generation now working in the nursery. And to celebrate these 85 years, they're doing all sorts of special seminars, special sales, things like that. Well, yesterday they had a seminar David Rodriguez gave. And if you want to see all the upcoming things, simply go to the website at Fanick, F-A-N-I-C-K, FannickNursery.com. So far as I know, they have extended the sale that they started yesterday, and that's 20% off all products from Fertilome and High Yield and Natural Guard. That goes on through the day-to-day. So if those are products that you use, why not get over and save some money? It's also a great time to visit Fanick's because they are so well-stocked on vegetables, on warm-season flowers. They've got a great new selection of, they've got more fruit trees in. They've got more shade trees in. And by the way, that CPS Energy Green Shade Program where you get a $50 rebate on your bill for shade trees you plant, that ends the end of April. So might want to get on over to Fanick's and see about picking up some trees that qualify. They also have a new shipment of gifts. They've got some wonderful wind spinners. They've got garden art. Just so many reasons to go by and see our friends at Fanick's. They're over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for 85 years. Check them out online at FannickNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Don tells me we've got some open lines, so if you're getting a busy signal there for a couple of minutes, it'd be a real good time to call. You know the number, 210-599-5555. Well, we say good morning to LaWanda. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
It's going to be a beautiful day.
It certainly is. Already is, and just going to get prettier.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it. I have three questions.
Okay.
And the first one is on my pomegranate bushes or trees.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to leaf out.
Right.
And but I don't see them flowering yet. Is it too early for that to happen?
Yes, it is. Like I was just talking with AJ, the air temperature's been real nice for us humans, but up until just the past week or two, the soil really hadn't started warming up much. And it's weird. I mean, I've got pecan trees that are barely putting on leaves now, and yet a few other things came out very early. But no, that soil has stayed very cool with our cooler nights. And I don't know about you. I love sleeping with the window on or open and a couple of things piled up on top of me. But the cooler nighttime temperatures have simply kept the soil cooler than happens many years. And a lot of plants are just, they don't look at the calendar. They don't know they were supposed to, you know, start out 30 days earlier. So your pomegranates, assuming they're in good sun, they'll probably be blooming in another 2-3 weeks. But it's just that the soil has stayed cool longer than usual this spring, and there are just an awful lot of things that are behind according to the calendar, but as far as they know, they're right on time.
Oh, okay. Well, good. That's good to know. So how often would you fertilize them at this time and water?
If you're using a dry granular fertilizer, do it every couple of months. If you're using a water soluble like Hastagrow or one of the liquids, use it every couple of weeks. And watering is just like it always is. When you water, really flood it thoroughly and use your index finger. When you can stick it down in and it's getting good and dry about an inch deep, it's time to water them again. That'll depend on how sunny it is, how windy it is, how warm it is. And it may be you'll have a few weeks where you have to water every 3 days, and then you'll have a period where you only have to water once a week. But you can't do it by the calendar. You just have to feel the soil and water when it's dried to the proper point. And with pomegranates and with most everything else, that's going to be about a knuckle deep, about an inch deep.
Okay, that's good to know. And then once they do start producing, say I do get pomegranates, do you still continue to water the same, as you said?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Pomegranates suffered last summer when we had the extreme heat, and, you know, we're about 3 years into a drought now. And when you water, just remember there's no such thing as too much water. There is too often. But when you water, those roots are deep. They can be, depending on where you live, several feet down into the ground, and you've got to water enough to get the water all the way down to that root system. So Turn the hose on slowly, let it soak, and that's how to water them. They are drought tolerant, but you'll get the fruit won't be nearly as good if you grow them on the dry side. They like to be on the moist side, and that's what'll give you that real succulent fruit. If not, it'll be kind of dried up inside that little skin, the kind of leathery skin that covers a pomegranate. So be sure that you're watering thoroughly when you water.
Excellent, yes. That's good to know. Thank you, Bob, on the
Certainly.
Pomegranates. And on the, we have some trees that we want to cut the branches off because they're bowing. And in particular, we have oak trees that we want to do that too.
Okay.
Is it a good time to do that?
Are we talking live oaks or red oaks? What kind of oaks?
Live oaks.
Okay. You can certainly trim on live oaks, but remember, every wound, no matter how large or how small, needs to be sealed. You don't have to use pruning paint. You can use any kind of paint, but it's whether it's the size of your little finger or whether it's the size of your wrist. Any wound that you make on a live oak, really any time of year, but especially this time of year, is a place mm-hmm. where you could potentially get oak wilt started. So spray it, you know, paint it, do whatever. You have to keep it sealed for about 10 days. After that, the wood is dried naturally enough that the oak wilt fungus can't get started. But find time to prune, but just be sure that you can paint those wounds when you do so.
Okay, and just be cut and then just right away put that the paint or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what
right
happens
there and then. Okay.
when you cut on the tree, it bleeds a little bit in effect. It oozes some sap out of that wound, and that wound mm-hmm. is attractive to a little beetle called a nitty-doodly beetle or an ambrosia beetle. There's several different ones, and they may have been off feeding on dead red oaks where there were spores. Live oaks, if they die of oak wilt, they don't make any spores. They don't make any reproductive structures. But if you've got, you know, red oaks within 10 miles of you really that have died of oak wilt, they can form what they call a spore mat underneath the bark. The beetles go in to feed on some of the stuff that's in that, and then they fly off looking for wounds on trees. And when they go and start feeding on the sap, oozing from the wound on your tree, then they can bring in the little fungal spore that causes oak wilt. And it only takes one to, you know, have just a devastating disease get started. So you want to paint each wound. And after, like say, after about 10 days, that wound shrivels up. It's dried to the point that fungus spore mm-hmm. can't germinate. So it's only important to get it sealed for 10 days. So you can use any kind of spray paint. You could use nail polish if you wanted to. But anything that just seals it up so the beetles can't get to the fresh wound.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's very helpful. Yes, I don't want to lose my oak trees.
Absolutely
sure.
not. Absolutely not.
And one last question on my mountain laurels. You know, they're beautiful and have already flowered and flowers already gone. But now I'm showing red flying bugs out there. I mean, it's like they go from one mountain laurel to another mountain laurel and they suck up all the new growth.
Yeah.
Any idea how to get rid of those?
Spray with spinosad, or better still, something called spinosad soap, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. It's totally safe for you, totally safe for pets and everything except various insects, including that little, they call it a mountain laurel bug. It's kind of red and black. The spinosad soap will take care of it very quickly.
Oh, okay. Yes, because seems like we spray and we go out and look, they're there again, new ones.
I guess the good news is that they only, you know, come at a certain time of the year and they're not here long. This is about the only time of year we see them. But while they're here, they're a pest. And, you know, you kill a bunch of them and a few more of them move in. Probably another month or so by the time Mother's Day gets here, they're usually through with that cycle of reproducing. So probably won't have to worry about them until next year. But in the meantime, you may have to spray two or three times.
Okay, and this is the first time we've seen them, and we've been here about 15 years and, you know, we've had the mountain laurels, but it's the first year we see those red and black pine buds.
You're lucky. Most of us have seen them a lot more than that, but for whatever reason, this is just the, you know, apparently the perfect weather for a lot of things. We're seeing more different kinds of caterpillars than I've ever seen. It's just so many things in nature are cyclical, and this is just the weather has cycled around to where this was just the perfect storm, so to speak, for mountain laurels bugs to reproduce prolifically. Hopefully it'll be years before you see them again.
Oh, I hope so. All righty, Bob. I thank you so much. You've been a great help, like usual. And you have a very nice, blessed day.
You do the same. Appreciate it, Wanda. And everybody else, give me a call, 210-599-5555, while I talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And had a just a great visit earlier this week with Danny Bowes, the owner of Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And we're just talking about the quality of the material, the Galvalume material that truly is a lifetime material. You may be one of the ones that suffered some hail damage over the past few weeks. A lot of people around the area have gotten hail damage. And what a great time it would be to make the switch. Get away from those old shingles that you have to replace every few years and put on the last roof you'll ever put on your home. That's what Danny says. Do it once, do it for life. And I'm here to tell you he's right. He put the roof on my home over 20 years ago, and it's been absolutely perfect. Haven't called him with a single problem. Put the roof on our Shades of Green quite a few years ago. Same way, our roof stood up to baseball-sized hail. Not hardly a dimple here or there, but the roof is beautiful as it always has been. Have so many friends that have made that switch, gone with Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and every one of them absolutely loves it. A quality metal roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems is not that expensive, not that much more than just replacing with the shingles that, you know, are just going to, you're going to be doing the same thing, a real mess a few years from now. So why not make the switch, especially if you've got a little bit of insurance money coming in from the hailstones, which a lot of people do. Do it right. Do it with the Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof that's so energy efficient it'll save money on your energy bill every month. Your homeowner's insurance will probably give you a discount on your policy because they know they're not going to have to replace that roof ever again. Just a lot of reasons to make the switch, not to mention they're beautiful roofs, lots of different choices and styles these days as well. Dial 822-6868, 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday morning out there. It looks like we're going to be visiting with Laurel and Vera and Tony. Laurel is first in line. Good morning, Laurel.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I bought something just as an experiment, and was wondering if you knew anything about it. I bought some blue creeping thyme seed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As a ground cover. Is this just something I fell for online, or have you heard of this?
There are many different kinds of thyme. I've not, and most times, in fact, every time I can think of, is a creeping type. Some of them have different flavors. Some of them have, you know, tiny, tiny leaves. Some of them are a little bit larger leafed. I don't know one, you know, called blue thyme, but I suspect it will be just fine. To grow thyme well, it needs full sun. It needs soil that drains well. And it, I guess you could say it would make a ground cover. It's not anything you can walk on. And
right.
But it does, you know, get thick. You grow it on the dry side, and like I say, lots of sun. It can be pretty and last for many, many years. And that's there. Like I say, lots of varieties of thyme out there, from lemon thyme to mother of thyme to, you know, creeping thyme. I just have not heard of blue thyme. In general, it's not as easy to grow from seed as it is to grow from cutting. So it's going to be fairly fine seeds. You'll want to you may want to start it in little pots and then plant it out after it gets up and growing. So it's
okay.
Like I say, it's not the easiest thing to grow from seed, but plant soil that drains well, give it plenty of sun. I'll look forward to hearing how it does for you. I suspect it'll do just fine.
Okay. Okay. And then I had another question about bluebonnet seeds. I bought a quarter of a pound this year just to try from the, what is it, the
Wild Seed Farms?
Yes, and not one of them came up.
When did you plant them?
November.
It's, October is the season we usually plant. Did you do anything to scarify the seed or anything before you put it out?
Okay. No, I did not.
Yeah, bluebonnet seed is, Mother Nature gives it a real tough outer coating so it can lie there for several years without, you know, so that if we say had a prolonged drought or for whatever reason, we just didn't have weather suitable for it to germinate, maybe 10 years down the road, the season would be right, the weather would be right, and we'd still have viable seed out there to sprout and grow. So it probably was older seed, which meant the seed was even tougher. And if you really want to get bluebonnet seed to germinate more quickly, you can scarify it, which means just scratching it. You're not sawing a hole in the seed, but you scarify it, you soak it in things like Garrett juice, and this increases the percentage of seed that will germinate. Now, I'm surprised that you didn't have any of it come up, but also remember, too, that bluebonnets go through, in effect, two life stages. They make a little low, flat rosette of leaves, which is what they form in the fall. Then in the spring, they make their upright growth, which comes up and gives you the flowers. They are very susceptible to damage by pill bugs, by certain beetles, even by snails and slugs. So it might be that you've just had fewer of them germinate and the bugs got to the few of them that did. So this next fall, plant early. Plant in October. You can even, many nurseries actually have little bluebonnet plants that if you want to be sure you get some, you can just get a few little 4-inch pots. They're not very expensive and plant out. But scarify your seed, give it a good Garrett juice soak, and plant it, like say, a little earlier, late October or very early November. And provided we get the rains through the winter months, then you'll have a good show in the spring. The worst thing that can happen is to plant it early. Then we get enough rain to get the little seeds to germinate, and then all of a sudden it turns off dry, and they just shrivel up and die. So it was sort of a combination of good things that got things, why we had such beautiful bluebonnets this year. But a lot of the ones that you saw come up and bloom, those may be seed that have been lying there for 8 or 10 years. So don't feel like Mother Nature mistreated you. There are ways to improve your chances of success, but nothing wrong that you did. It's just that seed can be tough. There are things you can do to speed it up, but it's tough seed, and Mother Nature designed it that way so that it could go through several bad years if it, if our weather just wasn't conducive to having it come up. Worst thing that can happen, like I say, they come up and try to grow, and then it turns off dry, and the plant just dies without blooming or making more seed. And that's why Mother Nature designed that seed so it could lie there for years if it had to before it came up and bloomed.
Okay. Yeah, this is pasture land, and we just mowed it real low, and then sprinkled the seeds and used a hard rake and just raked over it a few times.
Sure.
I don't need to have totally bare dirt, do I?
No. You just the seed needs to make good contact with the soil, and like I say, scarifying and the good little soak, and I think it's probably the apple cider vinegar and the Garrett juice that gets that seed activated, but. Let's talk about 1st of October next year, and we'll go over things that you can do to increase your chances of success. In the meantime, see if you can get us some rain so everything will be a little better.
Well, we actually had a good 15, 16 inches of rain. That's why I was shocked that they didn't come up.
Yeah. It just takes more than water. It takes freeze-thaw, a lot of different things to break that hard seed coat so that the little plant can sprout and grow.
Well, I'm definitely going to try that, Ben. And then I had one more question. I'm trying start a cactus bed. But the cactus soil is so expensive. Mm-hmm. Can I plant those? We have a ton of mushroom compost.
Uh-huh.
Can I plant in compost?
I wouldn't on cacti because compost tends to hold a lot of moisture. You can mix your compost with just some good topsoil or some, you know, just, my last caller was down in the sand country down south. Mix some other soil with your compost. And the only thing that, you know, makes cactus soil a little different in that it drains real well. You moisten it, the water goes through, and it dries out more quickly. Regular potting soil just usually holds moisture too long, and that's why they've designed these mixtures that, you know, that you water them and they dry a little bit more quickly, which is what your cacti need. But, you can create your own. You might mix in a little bit of lava sand, stay low on the organic material and very low on the clay because you just don't want to have a tight soil that holds too much moisture. And you certainly don't need to add any of the materials as good as they are that hold moisture in the soil. At this point, you want soil that is loose, open, so it has plenty of oxygen, drains well, and you can create a great cactus bed. I would suggest, if you can, either berm the area up or create a raised bed just to ensure that you have perfect drainage, and then you should do fine. You don't have to go out and buy the most expensive soil. You can create a lot of your own.
Okay, what about actually the real, real pretty, we have river sand. Mm-hmm. That has come up on the banks with all the rain we had. It's real pretty white sand. Could I use some of that?
You could use some of that. Just when rivers flood, they leave behind what we call alluvial soil. That's why, you know, the really fertile lands are many times long river channels. But there's many times a lot of very fine material there that can form kind of a crust on the surface. I wouldn't use just pure alluvial soil because, like I say, it may be hard to moisten evenly and keep moist. So you can certainly include that in your mix, but I would never go 100% with that alluvial sand.
Yeah, but I can add a little.
Okay. Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, and I think that's it. I sure appreciate your help.
My pleasure, Laurel. I appreciate the call. You get out and enjoy a beautiful Sunday.
Yeah, I will. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you. All right. Got to get a break in here and get to talk about another wonderful material, which will be great in that cactus bed that she's creating. It's a rock mineral that is called azomite. Azomite is volcanic in origin. It's a naturally mined product. All man has done to it is ground it to the appropriate size. It's not chemically produced or treated in any way, and yet it is loaded with more different micronutrients and compounds than about anything else I've ever seen. I think probably of all the natural ores on Earth, azomite is one of the very best ones out there for use in gardening because it is very high in iron and zinc and manganese and cobalt and all the things that your plants need, but only small quantities of. Azomite tends to green things up if you have a yellowing problem, and it prevents yellowing when you work it into the soil at the time you're planting. Highly recommend it. I've used it for years. I went to a trade show, nursery trade show, a few years ago and was visiting with the man, and he had a piece of poster board that was top to bottom, all the different beneficial things that are in azomite. And I've seen it do some really remarkable things because so many times, you know, you have leaves that yellow, and you put the appropriate things on, well, the next set of leaves that comes out is green, but the old yellow ones are still there until they fall off. I've seen azomite actually green up leaves that have yellowed, bring them back to life, so to speak. And this includes periwinkles, includes citrus, just good stuff. Not too terribly expensive. Comes in two basic forms, a very, very fine powdered form called micronize that you can actually mix with water and spray. And then the one that I use most of, which is a little bit more granular and makes it a whole lot easier just to sling it out. It will never burn. There's never a bad time to use it, and I don't know of a single plant that wouldn't benefit from having it. Look for it at a favorite nursery or garden center. It's called Azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and right back to the phone lines. It's Vera's turn. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning.
Vera, good morning.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions. I brought some irises from my grandparents' place about 45 years ago. mm-hmm. and they are absolutely beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Do I separate those after they bloom?
If you want to or if you need to. You certainly don't have to do it every year, but if they've gotten to the point where they're just crowding each other out, you know, mm-hmm. the rhizomes, one seems to be growing on top of another, mm-hmm. you certainly can do it. The fall is a better time than the spring to separate them, but it's strictly up to you. I mean, they can go for years and years and years. I actually helped my partner with a bed of actually reblooming iris this year, and we probably had over a would have cut through dividing and digging, had over 100, you know, different starts of them, and yet they still came up, and I think she counted over 40 bloom spikes at one time, you know, on the nice little 3x3 plot that was left. So iris, the flowers don't last a long time, but they are beautiful and very, very durable.
They are gorgeous, and I do need to separate them. I moved them from Wisconsin to Texas,
uh-huh.
and I just was a little worried about when to separate them.
Well, and what is a general rule for bulbs of all types is to separate them opposite the season of their bloom. The German iris typically bloom in the spring, so we separate them in the fall. Things like Lycoris that bloom in the fall, we separate them in the spring. So that's the easy way to remember when to do your dividing and transplanting.
That is easy. Another question. I keep hearing that I need to keep a lemon tree in a pot. I know several people that have these beautiful 12-foot lemon trees.
Yeah. Well,
they have hundreds of lemons on them.
The truth is you need to be able to protect them in the winter. For many people, that means they have to put them in a pot to be able to bring them inside. There's nothing magic about being in a pot. It's just that when we get a really cold winter, sometimes it's hard to cover them to the point that they don't suffer damage, especially in a year like 2021 when we got down in single digits. But there's nothing magic about a pot. It just makes it a little easier to be sure your tree doesn't freeze.
Oh, okay. And then, being up here in Gillespie County, we're not getting any rain. And
right.
I'm wondering how often do I water crepe myrtles during these drought months? And
well, you want to water thoroughly whenever the soil is dry on the surface. Hang on a couple of minutes. Donald puts you in hold. We'll talk more here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening, and we got hit by the news break there, but I was talking with Vera about how often to water crepe myrtles and things like that up in Gillespie County. And crepe myrtles, how long have these plants been in the ground, Vera?
I just planted one yesterday.
Okay.
Because the molds got to it and it fell over. But I have two of them in the ground about 4 years.
Okay. Once they are well established, they are very drought tolerant. You probably don't need to water them more than every 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. Your new plant, with all of them, water super thoroughly. There's no such thing as too much water, only too often. So when you water them, really flood them. And then wait until you can stick your finger down in and it's dry a knuckle or two deep, and then water them again. Once they have been in the ground for several years, again, they can go for weeks or, you know, sometimes even months without water if they have to. But to keep them growing, to keep them blooming, probably the established ones every 3 or 4 weeks. The ones that are just starting out, it'll be a little bit more often than that. Remember that with crepe myrtles, too, it's also very important to be sure that you can see that root flare, see where the roots start coming out from the side, because virtually every crepe myrtle that's sold is too deep in the pot when you get it. So be sure you pull the soil back around it down to where the roots begin to flare out. But crepe myrtle should be easy. Also, with a newly planted one, water the soil, as I was saying, water it very thoroughly when you water it. But if you want to pick up that hose and just spray up and down the trunk as often as you like, it will absorb a lot of moisture directly through that smooth bark while it's getting its roots established. There's no way you could ever spray it down too much, and it would absolutely love you for it if you pick it up and do it every day. If you have the time, I envy you.
Oh, I do have the time, but thank you so much. That is so helpful. Thank you, Bob.
And keep in mind, moles don't really do that much damage to plant roots. Moles are creatures that eat insects and earthworms and things like that. Gophers are root eaters, and gophers can be very, very damaging to plants. Moles, yeah, they just kind of make unsightly tunnels back and forth, little raised areas in your beds and your grass. So figure out what you have. Gophers are relatively easy to trap. In my college days, I can't tell you how many gophers I trapped helping a professor who was doing some research on gopher adrenal glands, of all things. But I will claim to be a pretty good expert when it comes to trapping gophers, and I think that's more likely what you have if they've damaged crepe myrtles.
Yeah, we were tossing it up. Was it a mold or is it a gopher? Well,
yeah.
I took care of that with my 40.
So yep.
We're good right now. Thank you so much.
A lady after my own heart. It's yeah, a good thing. Well, you have a wonderful day, and we will talk again, Vera. And right now it's Tony's turn. Good morning, Tony.
Yeah, Bob, on the azomite that you were just talking about earlier, I got them micronized.
Uh-huh.
And can that just be, put into the ground, scratched into the ground with the micronized?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, sure. It's fine. It's a little more expensive because it takes a very expensive machine to micronize it, but it does not have to be mixed with water. They have just, ground it into such a fine particle size that you can keep it in suspension and spray it if you choose to, but it certainly doesn't mean you have to. You can just apply it directly to the ground. The fact that it is so finely powdered really increases the surface area, and it'll probably work faster. It's just a little more expensive and a little bit more of a mess to try to spread around, but it'll never burn. You'll never use too much of it. It'll just, the only thing it'll hurt if you overdo it is the bank account. But it's not that expensive to begin with.
All right. And if you mix it with water, how much to a gallon about?
The water is just a carrier, so it doesn't really matter. I would say if I were going to run it through a sprayer, I'd probably put about half a cup to a gallon. But just remember, you need to keep shaking it, or, some of your bigger sprayers, your agricultural sprayers, have like a bubbler that goes in that tank that keeps things agitated, as they call it. But most of us just use it, in a little homeowner hose in sprayer. And just as long as you keep kind of shaking while you're moving around with it, it'll stay in suspension just fine.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about LED lights.
Uh-huh.
For the seedlings, seed, is it just a regular, like I got some aquarium LED lights and they're really bright, but does it take a special LED for plants?
Well, that's a really good question. It's not necessarily a special bulb, but just like other like incandescent bulbs, different bulbs put out a different wavelength of light, and the only color of light that plants can use in their growth is in the blue end of the spectrum. So somewhere, on the packaging, it should give you an idea of whether it is whether the light output is more toward the warm side, which is the yellow to red rays, which really, it may influence flowering, but they don't help plant growth, or if it's toward the cooler side, the blues and the violets, that's what the plants use for their growth. So there are some very good LED lights out there that will support plant growth, but I can't say that every one of them is good, but if you've got LED lights that produce a good deal of light in the blue end of the spectrum, they'll be perfect for your seedlings or for mature plants, either one.
Okay, now does that mean it's still white, but it puts a blue, it has a blue, whatever you call it?
It's almost impossible to judge with your eyes. When we look at a rainbow, we can tell that sunlight is made up of everything from the far red to the deep violets. It's if it has a bluish or a violet cast to it, it's easier to look at a fluorescent light and tell. But you almost need a light meter of some sort that will tell you what the wavelength of the light is, or the packaging, I'm sure, has a phone number on there that you can call. But most of the packaging, if you search it, it will give you an idea of what the output is. And sometimes it's given in like a temperature of Kelvin, but it should give you some indication. If it's a cooler type of light, is probably going to be in the blue end of the spectrum. If it's a warmer light, it's going to be the yellows to the red. So you can look at it, but look at the packaging carefully, and if the package is already gone, go back wherever you got it and find another package that still has the information on it. Or I buy a lot of lights. We've got here in San Antonio, we've got some stores called Bulbs and Batteries or something like that, and I find those guys really know light. We used to have a great store here, that specialized in lighting, but they moved their strictly up in the Austin area now. But I like the guys at Bulbs and Batteries. They can tell me when I'm buying bulbs pretty much what the spectral output of them is.
That's that Battery Plus place, I guess.
The one that I shop's over on Austin Highway. I'm sure they have other places around too.
Okay. This thing has a little remote control with it, and you can change the light, I guess, for the looks of the aquarium. You can go to blue and red and yellow and all that, but that wouldn't necessarily mean it's that blue light when it's on blue, that it's that spectrum that you're looking for.
I'm not enough of an engineer to know how they're able to do that. It is definitely the blue end of the spectrum that you want. You're going to have to find somebody that's a little bit more of a physicist than me to give you that answer. I'm the biologist. I'll let the physicist handle things that are beyond my range of knowledge.
There you go. And I was out in the field the other day picking out, pulling bull nettle.
Uh-huh.
And came across a couple little plants. I guess they were wild onions.
Okay.
They had a little bloom on them, and they smelt just like an onion and looked like a tiny onion.
Uh-huh.
Are those edible?
I don't think they would hurt you, but I doubt that they're very tasty. Genus Allium is what the onions and many of the garlics and things are in, and there are dozens of different ones out there. So there are some wild onions. I don't know any of them that are toxic, but I think some of them are going to be, have a much better flavor than others do. But there's some things that grow wild, but I don't think you're going to find them to be nearly the quality of what you can plant in the garden.
Yeah, and along that thing, there was a nettle plant out there. I say it's a nettle plant. It was like the bull nettle, but it didn't have a flower, like a poppy on top.
Right.
It had these little bulb-like, and it's really thicker. The stem is thicker, and the thorns are much more potent. Man, my arms broke out in welts after I touched it, You wouldn't happen to know what kind of nettle that is, do you?
Oh, there are so many different. We need to differentiate, of course, between nettles and thistles. I've never seen as many different thistles as are out there this year. But what I have always known is bull nettle has a white flower, and it's a relatively low-growing plant. But there are a lot of different ones. It's actually a type of cactus that has little segments that are smaller than a soda straw in diameter. Their seed pods are red. They break into little segments that are, 3/4 of an inch long, and that stuff will hurt you, and many people have an allergic reaction to it, and deer and cattle and things pick it up in their legs and then spread it all over the place. And some people call it tasajillo. It's actually I believe it might be a choy. I'm not sure of that, but there are a lot of different things. I spent parts of three summers in a wildlife management area, and our saying out there was everything here either sticks you, stings you, or bites you. And I think that that covers a lot of the hill country as well. So if you ever can take a good picture of it, or you know, get a little sample of it, could probably tell you a little bit more.
Yeah, it was, like I said, just like bull nettle, but it wasn't as tall, and it was much thicker stems, you know, like twice the size of a bull nettle. But anyway, I think that's all I got for you today.
Well, you get out and have a wonderful Sunday, and I'll look forward to visiting again. I do appreciate the call.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tony. Let's see. I know I need to get a break in here. Let me see. I get to talk about Dr. Williamson, and that's another one of those things that another one of those people that I just love talking about. I've been very blessed to know a lot of good people, and when it comes to dentists, let me tell you, knew Dr. Williamson back when he worked with Dr. Staffel years ago. Boy, that was an unbeatable team. But Dr. Williamson himself is the most broadly trained dentist that I think I've ever met. So many dentists these days, it's more just a cleaning or filling. They're going to farm you out to somebody else. Well, the specialist is Dr. Williamson, because he can handle virtually anything right there in his office, all phases of dentistry. Dr. Staffel actually pioneered some of the different sedation dental techniques, which allows the dentist to accomplish a lot more in a single visit and make you a lot more comfortable while they're doing. If you favor that line of treatment, well, Dr. Williamson is very much an expert in that area as well. But the thing that really sets him apart, in my opinion, is that he is totally focused on you. He's not thinking about the next patient. He's not counting how many people he can see in a day. He's out to solve your dental problems and keep your oral health, you know, top-notch. They say good oral health can extend your life by 10 years or so. Well, he's the guy that can really help you maintain good oral health. And if your mouth's gotten a little out of shape over the years, there's never going to be any guilt or anything else. Just a man who is capable of bringing it back up to perfection. If you'd like to learn more, I hope you'll call or visit his office out in Northwest San Antonio on Cherry Ridge Drive. Phone number is 210-341-2569. 210-341-2569 for Dr. Williamson and Associates.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening here. And, we're going to talk, let's see here, to Jeff and Carolyn and Marie. Jeff is first in line. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, Bob. Love your show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Hey, I noticed a live oak tree in one corner of my property that I hadn't paid attention to. And I noticed the other day I walked over, there were no leaves on it, except for one branch was still alive or had leaves on it. There's some bark missing on it and kind of brown powdery, some kind of fungus. So there are no other tree, there are plenty of live oaks around this area, and you know, all of them have nice green pretty spring leaves on them. There are some smaller there are cedar trees all around this tree as well, which is one reason I didn't notice first that it was having problems. But there are some of those small cedar trees that are completely brown as well. I'm wondering if there's a way to tell if it's live.
It's probably not oak wilt. The missing bark, is it in a line down the trunk of the tree? Is it just random around the tree? Describe the bark
random,
loss.
It's random up into some of the branches. And this is a big tree. It's probably 18-inch diameter trunk tree, but some of the branches are missing the bark.
Well, if there's an area, especially if it's vertically up and down the trunk, you know, it could be a lightning strike. is one reason that you, and lightning, one lightning bolt can kill a tree. Sometimes it doesn't hurt them that much. Just kind of depends on the strength of the bolt. But if the bark loss is kind of scattered through the tree, and the fact that there, you know, there are dead cedars around it, it tells me that it probably is in an area with very, very thin soil, and it may just be a reaction to, you know, being into the third year of a drought and the extreme temperatures last summer. Right. Howard Garrett and I talked about this at one point, that one thing this year is that, you know, the live oaks normally shed 95% of their leaves at this time of the year, but most every live oak that I looked at here at the nursery and around my ranch, they shed like 100% of the leaves. I've never seen the leaf drop so complete on the trees, and which was unusual. But like your area, most of mine have come back. But in walking around, especially over near my partner's ranch, there are a couple of her neighbors where that you can tell the soil is just extremely thin. They're just big shelves of rock right up close to the surface. And we see a lot of oaks over there that are kind of like what you're describing. They have very little foliage, if any. And the fact that the bark is coming off means that this has probably been going on for 2 or 3 years. And like you say, you just haven't noticed because there's a lot of other vegetation around it. But it's so dry that we are seeing cedars, the ash juniper, we're seeing them die of drought at this point. So my guess is that it's probably environmental. Can you do anything about it? You know, it's hard to haul enough water to really make a difference, but giving it a little bit of Super Thrive, getting a little bit of Garrett juice, giving a little bit of actually corn water tea, which is just whole ground cornmeal soaked in water, pouring 5-gallon buckets of that around within maybe 10 feet of the trunk. All those things may help, but what you need more than anything else is about 6 inches of rain.
Right.
And okay. I'm seeing this a lot of places, and it always seems to be when I get out and, you know, and just look carefully at it, it's where the soil is the thinnest. And Howard Garrett uses, Howard's been a golfer, I think, for most of his life, and every golfer out there has a few old clubs. And he takes one of those and cuts the club head off at an angle and then uses that as a probe to be able to stick down in the ground and see how loose the soil is and many times tell where the rock is. I'd be willing to bet you that if you went around and, you know, tried that around your trees that have foliated well and then tried around this tree that hasn't, what you're going to find is that you've got like a shelf of rock just a lot closer to the surface. And again, you're not alone. There are, you know, tens of thousands of trees, maybe hundreds of thousands of trees in the hill country that look, you know, just like you're describing. The more definitive symptom of oak wilt, and even this is not 100% because a lightning strike can do the same, create the same thing. But when you look at, you know, the leaves, especially in the fall when it's getting ready to drop the leaves, you know, what we call chlorosis is where the veins remain green, but the tissue around it turns lighter colors. I'm sure you're familiar with that term. What a tree that has oak wilt, it's just the reverse. The leaf will retain a fairly good green color, but the veins turn first yellow, then kind of brownish, and it's called veinal necrosis. And like I say, it's just a reverse appearance for chlorosis. The veins look bad, but the rest of the leaf looks good, where it's the other way around in, you know, with other things. But with the oak wilt, you see this pattern of collapsing, dead-looking veins while the overall leaf is green. When you start seeing a number of leaves like that on the ground underneath your tree, pretty good indication you've probably got some oak wilt going on there. But what you're describing does not sound like oak wilt to me.
Okay. Well, I hope not. But I appreciate it.
Are there other trees near this tree that's in trouble?
Yeah, there are live oak trees within, you know, 75 feet okay. of this one.
If you
that look healthy and everything. So.
Well, if
and
you
the cedar trees around or the juniper trees around them are green.
Yeah, I'm almost going to bet you that this tree's just sitting on top of a huge shelf of rock. But what I was going to say, if there's any chance that it is oak wilt, you can pretty much ensure that the nearby trees don't get it by a couple of times a year, soaking some whole ground cornmeal in water, about 2 cups to a 5-gallon bucket of water, soak it overnight, and then just pour this around. You don't have to cover the whole root zone of the tree, but within about 10 feet of the trunk, you know, put on a tree this size, probably 4 or 5 5-gallon buckets. We call it corn water tea. Years ago, we just used straight whole ground cornmeal and had good results, but found that that sometimes brings in too many of the blasted hogs tearing the soil up. So we found it works just as well to soak your cornmeal overnight and then just pour that liquid out around the tree. And that, and I won't take the time to go into how it works, but it's a fungus that grows on the cornmeal called Trichoderma, which really boosts what passes for the immune system in the tree and many times will totally keep a tree from getting oak wilt even when trees close by have it. So that's what I've done on my ranch. I had a not-so-good neighbor at one point, and you drive down Highway 46, you can see all along his fence line, it's just a series of trees that died of oak wilt, gets up to my property line, and I have trees within 10 feet of his dead trees that are 100% healthy and green. So it really does work.
Okay. And where do you get, like, a good amount of that?
Feed stores. The cheapest place is going to be somewhere that, you know, that makes their own feed. Whereabouts are you located?
Bergheim.
Okay, probably Lenders over in Comfort is going to be the closest feed mill that would have it, and you could buy it by the pallet over there if you wanted to. Any good feed store is probably going to have it in 40-pound bags, but if you're looking at needing a bunch of it, somewhere like Lenders that formulates their own feed, they're going to have it at a very, very low price, and it doesn't have to be top quality. I mean, again, it's not the cornmeal you're looking for. It's the fungus that grows on the cornmeal that's going to give you the protection.
Okay. All righty.
You get out and have a good Sunday. Do a rain dance. You're not too far away from me, and I'm ready for a small flood myself.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Very good. Well, this is my pleasure. Let me get a break in here, and we'll continue with phone calls. Looks like I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited. And once again, talking about the area where we live up there, that's the big news from Wild Birds Unlimited right now, is that they have opened a second location. Now, the whole chain, so to speak, Wild Birds Unlimited, there are franchise stores all over the place. Each store, though, is independently owned. They shop for their own gift merchandise and things like that. And, you know, for years, I've told you about the store here in San Antonio out near the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner. Well, the same folks that own that store have opened a Burney location. Now, way up on the north end of town, if you're going out Main Street, headed up north toward Comfort, you come to Market Street, and right there, very close there, is where the new Wild Birds Unlimited store. And Kyle and his staff have just, they've stocked it up just the way they have the San Antonio store and have the same great knowledge there to help you. It's just kind of a little mirror image of their wonderful store that they have and still will continue to have here in San Antonio. It's just more convenient for folks up in the Hill Country. And just like in San Antonio, they have a great selection of gift merchandise as well as having everything you could want related to the hobby of birding. Give them a call, get by and see them, and be glad you don't have to drive all the way to San Antonio to find those top quality Wild Birds Unlimited products. Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to the phone lines. It's going to be Carolyn, Marie, and Tony. Carolyn is first in line. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning. I have one question. I'm thinking about buying a composting tumbler, and I needed to know what your opinion is and what to expect.
I would say don't. And here's the reason. When good compost is partially derived from bacteria and partially derived from different fungi that are present in the material as it breaks down, the bacteria, of course, are just tiny. They can be, you know, individual or in small clusters. but many of the best of the fungi, they're like, we call it filamentous. They have long kind of fiber-like growths that move out through the compost pile. When you turn that pile frequently, or when you put it in a tumbler and you're spinning it around all the time, you're almost totally destroying the fungal component. You'll still get bacterially produced compost, but it's not going to be good, as good as compost that is produced from both bacteria and fungi. All of your bigger compost producers these days have gone to what they call static pile composting, which means you pile your materials up, but you only turn them maybe once every 3 to 6 months or something like that. And it's just better compost than you're ever going to make in one of these little tumblers. I mean, it might be good exercise. I guess it's fun to get out there and spin it around and watch everything get mixed up, but it doesn't make nearly as good a compost as if you just had an ordinary compost pile and turned it every few months instead of every day.
Well, I had a compost pile that I built, and it was I did a wire cage around it, and then I had it sitting there for about a year, and it had pretty decent compost when I dismantled it. But that's the problem, you know. I'm getting older, and dismantling and doing all this stuff is very difficult. So I just wondered if that compost in those tumblers is any good at all. You know?
Well, it's good, but it's not as good. I would say if it makes it easier, you know, put your materials in there, but don't do like they say and turn it twice a day or something like that. Put it in there and only turn it once a month or something like that.
Okay.
And you will produce a better compost. And if that makes it easier for you to handle, then it would be a good plan.
Oh, okay. So it's not just a big loss.
Right.
Okay.
No.
What, all right. What, okay. So just turn it about once a month. And what can, what they, the ones I saw online, they have two compartments, one on each side. And some of them have a handle and some you have to turn the whole thing with your hand. So what about the ones with the handle?
Well, again, it might be easier, but remember, you're only going to be doing it once a month. You're not going to be doing it every day. Just, you know, act like you put a couple of hen eggs in there, and you don't want to turn it so much that you're busting those eggs up, because that's in effect what you're doing. You're breaking and destroying some of the good fungi that are trying to grow in your compost. So that's why you don't want to turn it too vigorously or too often, because it develops better things when it's undisturbed, so to speak. But as far, I mean, by all means, look at how easy it is to load and unload, and again, if it's a little more trouble to turn, you're going to be doing it so infrequently, you might have, you know, a nice strong friend come over once a month and say, you know, I'll make you a cup of coffee if you'll flip my compost over a couple of times. The benefit would be the ease of handling, and but in effect, you're just going to have a static compost pile that just happens to be in a tumbler instead of down on the ground where it's a little bit harder to work with.
And it doesn't need to get air in it, you know, air?
Well, that's, yes, it does need air, but you don't need to be spinning it around to get the air in there. I'm sure these things are probably made of wire or something like that with open sides, so it's going to get all the oxygen it needs. You will need to moisten it periodically, just as you would if it was on the ground, but I would certainly never recommend something that was like a metal drum or a plastic drum or something like that. I'd want something that, you know, was made with a mesh type wire or something like that, so that you do get plenty of air into it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the call this morning. Get out and have a good Sunday.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Marie, let me get a quick break out of the way. You will be up next, and then Tommy. Looks like I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and that, again, is such a pleasure. I've known Rhonda Bohm for years and her family and staff, and Rhonda's Nature's Way is just a great place, and I tell you, they've helped me in so many different ways. You just, especially as you get a little older, you may have a few aches and pains. You may suffer from things like digestive issues or sleep issues or maybe even mood issues. I hope not. But you don't have to go running to the doctor every time you've got something like this. She's got wonderful natural products that do a world to alleviate even chronic pain. She's got great products, things I get from her, to keep your immune system strong so that you simply stay healthier. She's got wonderful supplements of all sorts, far better than you're going to find in a chain pharmacy or a grocery store shelf. She knows quality, and that's what she wants to help you with. Plus, she has the knowledge and the ability to help know what you need. Probably one of the most recent things I talked to her about was, you know, sometimes when I'm really working hard, I get some muscle cramps at night. Well, she was able to give me a product. I take a couple of morning and evening, and muscle cramps are a thing of the past. Rhonda is so knowledgeable, as are her staff members, and she's always there to help you. Stores open Monday through Saturday, always closed on Sundays and major holidays. And she not only has a supplement, she has things that really taste good. Check out something called Simply Protein if you're trying to lose a little bit of weight but you don't want to give up flavor. If you work out in the heat as I do and you really need to keep your electrolytes up, don't be drinking these sugar-filled sports drinks. Get some of the Ultima. Tastes wonderful. Gives you all the electrolytes you need without a lot of calories. And that's just, I could go on and on about Rhonda. And the, you know, things she does, like reflexology there at the store. Located out in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. If you want to live better naturally like I do, get out and see my friends at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Next in line is Marie. Then it'll be Tommy and Jackie. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have two unrelated questions.
Okay.
And one is another live oak tree question. I planted a live oak tree about 5 years ago. It's out in the middle of the field. It gets full sun. It has good soil, and it's been doing great. And I checked it the other day, and on the tips of the branches is a kind of purplish, half of a pea-sized bald on all, just covering all the tips of the branches. And I'd never seen that before. And if you break them open, there's like a little powder in there.
Right. It's what we call a gall. There are different galls that are produced by insects, occasionally by bacteria or even fungi. It's basically harmless to the tree, but what it tells you is that your tree is under a bit of stress. You normally don't see this on a stress-free tree. With the heat last summer, with the ongoing drought, which has been going on for several years now, virtually every tree out there is stressed at least to some degree. So it's not anything I would worry about. I would look carefully at the base of the tree, be sure that root flare is exposed. If you want to do something for the tree, you can go to Howard Garrett's website, which is dirtdoctor.com, and look up what they call sick tree treatment. There's a company called Maestro Grow that is actually packaging all the ingredients into one bag. But the first step in the process is always check and be sure that you can see that root flare, that it's right up on the surface of the ground. So don't think it's anything to lose sleep over. I think your tree is not suffering terribly. But when you start seeing these little galls, it tells you that the tree's just saying, hey, I could be happier. And, you know, other than just the drought stress, which you can try to take care of, hauling water, although it's you know, hard to get enough water to a tree like that. But if it were mine, I'd probably get a bag of sick tree treatment to put around it.
Okay. All right. And I did the cornmeal treatment. So I've done that twice in the
Excellent.
Last year or so. Okay. And
well,
the other question.
Well, go do a rain dance and make it rain. That'll be the best thing you can do for all of us. But
okay.
Short of that, what's that other question?
I started above-ground gardening. I ordered these big containers, and on the brochure, it suggested, I forget the name of the method, starts with a K, where you pile your logs on the bottom, and then branches, and then you pile. What do you think about that?
It's called hooviculture, and I think it's a waste of time. I mean, it is an awful lot of work, and you're putting a lot of very raw, undecomposed materials and very large materials, which are going to be very, very slow to break down. Now, I've got a friend up in Colorado who's doing some of this, and he's on a hillside where it's probably fine because it slows down the water running down the hill and all. But in general, just a good mulch is going to accomplish the same thing with a whole lot less work, and it's going to produce a whole lot faster results. It's, I don't want to call it a gimmick, but it's, I don't know, it's a practice that, you know, they use in European countries and a few places around. But here in Texas, you know, just a good layer of mulch on the surface of the soil will accomplish the same thing with a lot less expense and a lot less backbreaking labor.
Okay. Well, you've answered my question. Thank you so much.
I just remember gardening should be fun. If it starts sounding like work, you know, then you're not doing the right thing. And granted, having a big garden will take a lot of time and a lot of effort. But to me, it's just, well, I love the bumper sticker I saw recently said that gardening is cheaper than therapy and you get tomatoes. it's a good thing. So anytime you read something and you say, wow, that sounds like an awful lot of work, then I think there may be a better way of accomplishing the same thing. I guess that would sum it up in a nutshell.
Okay, thank you.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I do appreciate the call this morning. And I believe that gets us up to Tommy. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Bob. I got
morning,
a couple
sir.
Questions. One question is loquat trees. How long does it take before they start bearing fruit? I have one that's 12 years old and it's maybe starting to bear fruit this year. But.
Yeah, it ought to take about 3 years.
Right.
But you know, every seed is different. So the genetics in every seed, you know, are different. What happens a lot of times, you know, loquats bloom in the fall and then produce fruit in the spring. The past 3 years, about the time, you know, either when they are in bloom or right after they've bloomed, we've had extremely cold weather. It was in January this year. And many times, at least the past 3 years and a number of other times in the past, the cold has come at a time that actually froze the little fruit, even though sometimes you couldn't even see it. It was so small. But very few loquats have had much fruit, and it's all been weather-related. So your loquat may have tried, but the weather's just been against us. You're only going to have good fruit production in a relatively mild winter, because when it sets fruit in the fall but doesn't ripen it until spring, anytime we get a hard freeze between, say, October and March, it can just totally ruin your crop for the year. So it's probably a combination of a younger plant, but it's more weather than anything else. I'd almost promise you that, Tommy.
Okay, because my neighbors down the corner, their tree is just full of fruit, and that's why I was wondering what was going on. We're in a little valley, which gets colder in the area, but
yeah.
Maybe that was it. I don't know.
That probably has a lot to do with it. You know, fertilize it. Be sure it's got I rarely see a plant fail to produce because it doesn't have enough phosphorus. There usually is plenty of that in the soil, and most every kind of fertilizer has all the phosphorus you would ever need. So do put some fertilizer on it 3 or 4 times a year, but hopefully we are headed into a period of milder weather. And first thing you know, you should have enough loquat fruit to feed all the possums in your family as well.
Okay, I got plenty of squirrels. Do they eat it?
not as much as possums and raccoons, but they will eat it to some extent, that's for sure.
Okay, got a raccoon too. So, okay, the other question is the plum tree had a bunch of blossoms, I mean full, but no fruit. What's going on with that?
That probably was, again, a late freeze after, you know, it had bloomed and set fruit. You end up with, you know, the little just barely developing embryos. You can hardly even see them. And, again, we got our coldest weather of the winter in January after a lot of fruit trees had bloomed, and consequently very, very low fruit production. The only plums that I've seen that have really born fairly heavily were in protected areas where they didn't get as much cold.
Okay. All right. That's probably that answers the questions then. Hey, thank you, Bob. Thank you for everything you do.
It's always a pleasure. have a good Sunday, Tommy. Thank you. All right, Jackie, I don't want to rush you. We're getting pretty close to news time, so we'll just make you up first after the news. Do want to remind everybody that we are seeing lots of June bugs out there. The June bugs are what lay the eggs for the grubworms, and it's not the big old grubs you see. It's the first little, they're called first and second larval instars, little tiny grubs. Those are the ones that do the super damage to your yard. So pay attention to your porch light. If you're starting to see a bunch of June bugs out there, get some beneficial nematodes and put them out. We saw a lot of people lost a lot of grass to grubworm damage this past year, and the damage should show up immediately. Many times it's 6 or 8 weeks after the roots get cut before the grass starts to die, but unfortunately, once that happens, you can't reverse it. So if you're seeing June bugs, get some nematodes out. You'll also be taking care of fleas and fire ants at the same time. So it's a good thing to do, and not very expensive, just a small amount of work. Also, I'm going to declare it warm enough now that I think you're okay to start planting periwinkles in the garden, right on the verge of being warm enough to plant okra. Check your forecast. If you're San Antonio South, you're probably fine. Up in the hill country, you may want to wait just a week or 10 days, but getting really close to time to plant okra. And, of course, you can continue to plant squash and cucumbers, bush beans. I'm probably going to be switching over from Tavera to Top Crop or Contender, one of the more really hot weather bush beans, because you're probably going to grow several crops of them through the summer months if you really do enjoy beans. Also still plenty of time to plant tomatoes, but keep in mind that your bigger fruited tomatoes are not going to set fruit once the nights get hot. The fruit they're setting now is great. They'll continue to set fruit for a little while, but if you're setting out a little bitty plant, it's going to be a while before it blooms. I would recommend that you grow more with the cherry type tomatoes because they don't pay any attention to nighttime temperatures. They produce all summer long. But if you're trying to grow Brandywine or, you know, one of the big ones, may want to hold off until fall to plant those. Certainly all the peppers out there as well. Lots more to talk about. We'll do it after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. I know the phone lines have been kind of jammed up. Don tells me we do have some open lines now. Jackie is actually the only one holding, so be a real good time to dial 210-599-5555. One more hour left in this show, and then Dr. Kirby will be in, and we'll be talking your pet's health for the hour between 11 and 12. Right now, I get to say good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about my oak tree.
Okay.
This oak tree is old. It's at least more than 50 years old, I know.
Okay.
But the bark on it, it's got a place on about midway up on the bark that's about a foot in length. It looks like the bark is just exploding.
Uh-huh.
And I have no idea. I don't see any bugs, but I have no idea what this is.
And this is a live oak?
It is a live oak.
Okay. There's so many different possibilities, and none of them are really bad. Does the foliage look healthy on the tree? Does the tree look good overall?
Oh, yeah, it has been, yeah.
Okay. The tree bark does not stretch, so to speak, and the best analogy I can give you is like a snake or a lizard sheds their skin periodically because as they get bigger around, their skin doesn't stretch, so they shed it and form, you know, more skin underneath. And trees are the same way. Oak trees have that, live oaks have that really rough bark, and periodically some of it just kind of sloughs off and the tree makes new bark from underneath. Now, different things can knock off a given little patch of bark. Lightning strikes will do that. Most people don't realize it, but we have plenty of porcupines in this part of the world, and they are eaters of tree bark. So, if it's not just, you know, huge sections of it that are peeling off, I don't think it's anything to worry about. And if it's up on the trunk, You know, down low sometimes we'll get some physical damage. Somebody's run a riding mower into it, or worse still, a car or something like that, and it in effect bruises it and will cause it to, you know, lose some bark. But if it's higher up, that's probably not what's doing it. But I always look at the newest growth on the tree, and if it's got good, healthy, new foliage coming out all over the tree, then I'm pretty certain that it's absolutely nothing you should be concerned about.
Okay, good. I'm sorry, excuse me. This space on here is about a foot in length.
Okay.
And it's not just a little spot. It's about a foot in length where it looks
like. Is it a foot up and down, or is it? Yeah. That, again, I would not be at all surprised if you had not a real major lightning strike, but even just a just lightning can hit a tree like that and just, you know, sometimes pop a little bit of bark off. I was walking around my ranch one day after a fairly good lightning storm, and I just saw this line of bark about 10 feet long straight out from the tree. And I looked up, and from about 10 feet up in the tree down to about 18 inches from the ground, lightning had hit it and just blown a little section of bark off the side of the tree. The tree has continued to grow and live, and, you know, new bark has formed and sort of covered it over. So lots of different things can destroy a small bit of bark, but on a big mature tree like that, it shouldn't pose any threat to the tree. The tree should go on growing, and eventually it forms sort of a callus tissue, and then the bark from the edges of that split just starts growing inward, and 5 years from now you probably won't even be able to tell where there was a hole in the bark.
Okay. Now there's no burn places or anything like that.
No, they're usually
burned or blackened.
No, there normally would not be.
Okay. All righty. Well, the tree itself looks fairly healthy. I often wonder about it because when this house was built, we didn't want to lose that tree.
Mm-hmm.
The house was built within 10 feet or less of the tree.
Well, they probably cut some roots and almost certainly drove back and forth over the root zone, compacting the soil. But they probably did some minor damage to the root system. I would look at the base of the tree and be sure they didn't fill any dirt in around it. If it looks like a fence post coming up out of the ground, they buried that trunk, and you need to get that dirt pulled back to where you actually see that trunk spreading out, kind of flaring out down at the bottom. I was talking to an arborist friend, and not too far from where our nursery is, his guys had uncovered a pecan tree where the builders had started piling dirt around it. They had to go down 6 feet to find the root flare. And then they just kind of built a little silo around it, and that tree started looking better, you know, the day after they literally did it. But, and if a tree is severely buried, you don't have to worry about trying to pull the dirt away by hand. There's a tool called an air spade, runs off a compressor just like a jackhammer does, and an air spade just can quickly and safely it literally blows the dirt back away. And you know, a skilled person can do many, many trees in a single day. We had one of our trees here at the nursery done, turned out to be a problem with some girdling roots, and that tree has certainly looked better since Eder Tree Care came out and exposed the root flare a little bit better for us. So you can take a look at that and probably improve the health of the tree. As Howard Garrett likes to say about what they call the sick tree treatment, a tree doesn't have to be sick to benefit from it. So that might be something else you might want to look at, either on the website and just Google sick tree treatment, or MaestroGrow actually packages all the ingredients in it in one bag. And it doesn't ever hurt to put, you know, some of it around the tree. But the first and most important thing is going to be just to be sure that you can see the root flare at the base of that beautiful live oak.
Okay. I have another quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
My backyard is sinking. I mean, really sinking. We're out in the country. We live in a subdivision not far from Canyon Lake.
Okay.
And there's a lot, you know, it's rocks everywhere. But
uh-huh.
It's literally sinking. I have to go down an incline to cross the yard. And it's always been kind of at an angle anyway, but it's really sinking this past year. It's just, it kind of scares me. I don't know what's happening here.
Well, there are a couple of things. Of course, you're sure it's not eroding. You're sure that the soil's not washing away. You feel like
no.
It's actually the level's dropping?
No, there's grass.
Okay.
It's Bermuda grass and weeds.
Which we all have plenty of.
And stuff. But,
is it localized little areas, or is it the yard as a whole?
It's pretty much a good area, a good part of the backyard, yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, if you've ever had a tree, after a tree dies, the stump, the roots start to slowly decompose. And I've got areas in my yard, they're limited, but where the soil shrank down, you know, as much as 12 to 18 inches, where, you know, an old stump rotted away. In a couple of cases, it was tallow trees. In another case, it was mimosa tree. But if it's more widespread than that,
it is.
Yeah. And how old is your home? How long has it been there?
Well, this house has not been here but 7 years. The house that was here before burned down, and we had to rebuild. And that house was 50 years old.
Okay. You know, it's sometimes the builders just don't compact the soil properly, and it basically settles over time. Is your foundation still in good shape? Have you had any foundation issues?
The foundation looks fine, but there's a place in the back where you can see where the edge of the yard used to be, and that part has dropped down about, I'd say, about 10 inches or so.
Wow. They just didn't compact the soil when they came back and, you know, built up around the foundation. I don't think there's anything to worry about.
Let me add one more thing to this.
Okay.
You know, we're out in the country, and there's caves. Mm-hmm. All over the area. Mm-hmm. We used to be able to walk across the street, and there was an opening to a cave.
Uh-huh.
And they filled it in with big rocks and stuff. But also on our septic system is on the side of the house. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of pipes, entry to the pipes to the septic system, that are on top of the ground that you could go into the septic system if you needed mm-hmm. to service it.
Yeah.
Those things have raised up. In other words, the ground has fallen down, and those pipe openings have raised up about 6 inches, I think.
Okay. Well, you could have, you know, we see this is when you get down toward the coast, or especially in Louisiana, places where they pump a lot of oil out of the ground, it's called subsidence, and the soil actually sinks because they're pulling out the oil and the things underneath so that it sinks downward. Up in the hill country, we're dealing with what's called karst topography, and there will be places where sinkholes form. This is one way that we get, well, it is the one of the principal ways that water gets into our aquifers, and it may just be that you've got, you know, very porous rock structure underneath, and it is indeed sinking. Some of that soil is going downwards. That's not out of the question. But
is there anything I can do about it? Someone I can call?
There's no way you can stop it. You can add more soil on top, but there's, you know, again, if you've got big fissures in the rock and the soil is just, you know, gradually sinking, there's not really anything to do about that. It's not real common, but I know that, you know, in walking the hill country, we identify very large areas that are called sinkholes. And again, they're very, very important. It's illegal to fill them in because that's how the water gets into our aquifers when we get a good rain. But the person you would talk to would be a geologist. You might talk to what area are you in?
I'm in Cypress Cove, Spring Branch.
Yeah, you might talk to, it's probably going to be the Trinity Glenrose, the groundwater district up there. I think you're probably outside of the one that I serve, which is the Cow Creek groundwater district in Kendall County. But I think
I'm in Comal.
You're in Comal. Well, you've got a new groundwater district that was mandated about 5 years ago up there. You might call the groundwater district and ask if they have anyone that could take a look at it and maybe give you some idea there. You know, in Kendall County, we are supported by a very, very small tax, and we're out to, we do a lot of things for free for well owners, just because that's what, you know, the groundwater districts were formed to do. You've got a little bit different kind of groundwater district in Kendall County, but calling, at the very least, they would know whether that's a common problem in your area and might be able to make some suggestions.
Okay, and what did you say the name of that organization was?
It will be your groundwater district, your Comal County groundwater district.
Okay.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Well, that does it.
Well, let me know what you learn. I'd be interested in following this, Jackie.
Okay.
Thank you very much for
Thank
the call.
Thank you.
So you're
okay.
Welcome. Bye-bye. Goodbye. All right. Don, we better get a break in here. I've got all the lives done, so run the commercials. We'll get back to phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Looks like my next three callers are going to be Glenn and Roger and Mary Ann. Glenn is first in line. Good morning, Glenn.
Bob, good morning. How are you?
I'm off to a good start. It's going to be a real nice day. A little overcast, but man, that temperature is just makes you want to get out and do something.
It does. It does. And I'm out doing it now. But quick question. Actually, two questions. But on my peach trees, looks like I've got a good start. And I fertilized them back in late fall with Growing Green. What's the schedule for other applications of fertilizer approximately?
You know, if plants, trees that are growing actively, I like to see if you're using a dry granular, which is a lot easier. I figure about four times a year in just the beginning of the season. I try to say, okay, the first day of spring, first day of summer, first day of fall, first day of winter, because the release pattern on most of the granular fertilizers, Medina, Maestro Grow, and Nature's Creation, it's about 90 days is the period of time over which those nutrients will be used. Some things are used a little faster, some of them are used a little slower. But on actively growing trees, I would say every 90 days. On trees that are mature, that you're more interested in maintenance on, probably half that, about every 180 days. Do it the first day of the winter and the first day of the summer or something like that. And if you have, you know, any special stresses or things like that, switch over and use a liquid fertilizer a time or two. Even go so far as to spray it on the soft bark. Most fruit trees, at least while they're fairly young, have a soft, smooth bark as opposed to a real rough bark. And they actually absorb a great deal of moisture as well as some nutrient material through that bark. And it's just kind of like an IV. It just gets into the tree a little faster and certainly doesn't hurt anything.
Okay. Yeah, these are 4 or 5 years old, so they're they're past the baby tree stage.
Sure.
But I'll probably go ahead and put another application on them and then go from there. But my other question was on tomatillas. I put three in the ground this morning. I've got more, but I noticed on the ones that I put in the ground, they were a little bit bigger, and on the stem, they've got those little hairs similar to tomatoes. Is it beneficial to plant them deep up to that point where that changes to a green stem?
Not as much. Tomatoes are kind of unique in their ability to form roots up and down the stem. The little hair-like projections on the tomatillos, as I'm sure you've noticed, a much smoother outer covering in between. It helps to support them, and I think tomatillos, even more than tomatoes, do best with some support, whether it's a tomato cage or even staking. But I've never seen tomatillos respond to planting deeply the way tomatoes do. Don't think it'll hurt anything, but I don't think you really gain much either.
Okay. All right. Well, that answers that question. Yeah, I'll get out and be sure I stake them. I'm out of cages. I've got tomato plants this year. I've run out of cages, but anyway. Okay. Well, that answers my questions. I appreciate it. You have a good
day. you're certainly welcome. And you get out and have a good day and enjoy your gardening. And sounds like you're going to be ready to open your own roadside tomato stand if you've got that many going. And let's just hope we can stay away from the hail. And otherwise, it looks like most of us are going to have a much, much better tomato crop than we had last year. And if the weather will just cooperate, we'll have a lot to enjoy.
Yeah, you know, you talk about that roadside stand. I've mentioned that to Mama a couple of times, and I think I told you that I was told things that I don't think a sailor would tell people. So, anyway.
We all live among the characters in life, and sounds like you don't have any boring people in your life. You have some interesting people working hard to keep you honest, is the way I would put it. And believe me, I know the feeling.
yep. Okay. All right. Well, enjoy your rest of your day.
And you do the same, Glenn. It's good to hear from you. Thank you. Let's go on and talk with Roger next. Good morning, Roger.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Hey, listen, just a couple things. First, I want to put a short privacy hedge. I had some nice neighbors move in kitty corner across the street from us, and they thought they needed real, real bright lights there for the porch lights. So anyway.
I understand. Yep.
They have to be more or less drought proof if possible, and definitely deer proof, because we've got a lot of deer here living in the yard and around them. Then the other thing is it would have to be under power lines, so I don't want a 60-footer or anything. If anything, maybe 8 to 12 feet at the max, or you know, something like that would be good. I know that's a lot to ask. The only thing I know of is like what we call mountain cedar, because deer won't touch that.
Well, there are a number of things that they tend to leave alone. Fast growing things that are deer resistant, we just don't have a lot that grows quickly that the deer don't want to nibble on. And this is a front yard where you're going to be doing this?
Yeah, it's a front yard. It's along the edge of the yard. What it is, we have a pretty long driveway. And the next door neighbor to us has quite a few like bushes and trees, and kind of we're in the half wilderness area. It's not really super landscaped area. And so our neighbor is kind of kitty corner to us. So it's kind of like mostly blocked. I only need about an 8-foot section where you can just put a few in there to block that light. That's all I would need.
If the fastest thing that you could do, if there's any way that you can put up a trellis or a little bit of fencing or something like that you could have a fast growing vine on, it'd be possible, you know, to accomplish that in less than a year. The vine that I would suggest you try, and it's pretty deer resistant, is called Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. It's very closely related to our native cross vine, so it is tolerant of our soils, tolerant of our weather. If you ever get down toward the Pearl Market, down where the old Pearl Brewery is, boy, they've got cross vine going up three stories on a lot of those buildings. It blooms with beautiful flowers in the spring, which is just a nice bonus. It's evergreen. It's dense enough to give you certainly visual protection and light protection and even some sound protection. And you might do that in conjunction with something a little more tree-like, like a mountain laurel or something similar to that the deer typically leave alone. But if you want something and don't want to wait, 5 years for it to grow, I'd sure consider trying to do an arbor, a trellis, something that would be attractive in and of itself physically, but then plant some Tangerine Beauty Crossvine around it, and you'll be amazed how quickly it will grow and cover, and it will grow about 2 feet taller than whatever it's growing on. If you do like a 6-foot arbor of some sort, the vine will actually kind of just, from the strength of standing up, it'll wind up about 2 feet taller than that. So that's going to be the fastest way to get a screen.
And I think I'm familiar. That's like a salmon-colored flower or something like that.
It's a salmon orange. It's more toward orange than it is salmon, but grapevine, totally cold-hardy, fast-growing, and, you know, deer resistant. Nothing is deer proof when you first plant it. And this is the other problem that just about everybody faces. The people who grow and produce these plants tend to use chemical fertilizers. They're trying to grow them as quickly as possible to get them on the market and make some money. Consequently, the plants sort of outgrow their ability to produce the compounds, the more aromatic things that make the deer want to stay away from them. And, you know, even things that are typically very deer resistant, sometimes the first few months they're in the ground, making very fast growth, the deer will come up and nibble on them. Once you get on an organic program, even though the growth slows down a little bit, the production of the aromatic compounds, and this is true whether it's rosemary or whether it's Mount Laurel or whether it's Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. Anyway, once the production of the aromatic compounds picks up, the deer all of a sudden don't like nosing around it and eating it. So don't be horribly discouraged if they want to go nibble on it a little bit at first. And you can certainly discourage that with products like Liquid Fence, or there's a deer repellent from a company called Imus Garden. And pretty good at keeping them away for about 30 days, but you have to remember to reapply, because I think those deer have a calendar. On day 31, they're going to be back and start eating on it if you haven't sprayed again. But given a little time, the Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is, you know, naturally deer repellent. Faster growing would be Confederate Jasmine, but I don't think it's going to be quite as deer repellent, and it has suffered a little bit of damage in our cold winters, but it's another one that'll go from ground level to 8 feet up in about 3 months' time. So you could even plant a combination if you want, but just overall hardiness and deer resistance, the Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is going to be hard to beat.
I think that's a great idea. I'm going to try that. I've had the Confederate Jasmine not do so well with the, uh-huh, the colder winters we've been having. So yeah,
right. And you know, I can't see your home, can't see the bed, but sometimes, you know, you can be creative. It doesn't necessarily have to be a, you know, real formal trellis. It can be almost like a pergola. It could be an interesting, you know, old tree skeleton of a madrone or something like that. It just, the vines just need something to grow up and over, and be as creative as you want to in creating that.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea, Bob. One more quick question. I don't know if this is true or not. We have a septic tank here, and the guy that services us, he told us that rosemary plants, the roots of those, can really get into septic tanks and to not plant rosemary anywhere near them. Have you heard that or
never?
Yeah, I don't know why that would be more than any other plant, but who knows?
I don't either, and it's funny the things that, like, here you can imagine. As long as I've been doing this, the things I've heard, so to speak. But I think it just amazes me. I think some people think that tree and shrubs, the roots have little drills on them that, you know, drill down into the pipe. A root is not going to get into a pipe unless there's already a hole in it. They don't bore their way in. The old clay tile lines, yeah, they leaked a lot and the roots got in a lot of different ways. But a modern line going to a septic tank, you're not likely to have any roots get into it. Now, out in your drain field, leach field, whatever you want to call it, that is done with perforated pipes so that the liquids get out and into the soil. But again, my field is out where I've got probably 150-year-old oak trees, and I occasionally have to get somebody to run their little snake down through the portion between the house and the septic tank. But my drain field, I've never had a problem, and it's only been there 80 or 90 years. So I wouldn't put too much stock in thinking that rosemary's going to cause a problem. I can't imagine it. I would definitely not plant a willow tree or something like that there, but it'd be very, very strange to ever have a problem with rosemary.
I kind of thought so. And if I can put out a plea, please install your night lights to shine down and not out, not up.
Boy, isn't that the truth. There are times that I think that's what pellet guns were invented for, but I didn't say that. But people should be the thing that makes me maddest are some of the, and there's one of them out on 281, some of these service stations that, I mean, they're just totally destroyed our night sky. And, you know, I grew up as a kid really loving to watch the stars, and I feel like the kids today have to get 100 miles out of town before they can do that. And sadly, our Texas legislature has limited counties' ability to write ordinances and things that would protect night sky and things like that. But don't get me started on politics. It's too good a day to do that. So you get out and enjoy, and you create a nice little screen and enjoy a little bit more privacy.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. Don, guess we better get a break in here. We'll be right back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Going to be Mary Ann and Tom and E.T. Mary Ann is first. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. What's going on this beautiful day?
Hi. I live in North Texas, near the Wichita Falls area.
Way up north.
Yeah, way up north. I have a portion of my front yard that I've let kind of go native. I've got lots of wildflowers in it, and I'm trying my best not to use any weed killers in it. I don't water it. I don't fertilize it. I'm trying to let it just, it's going to have to do its thing on its own. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it has tons of burr clover in it, and I'm using, I get out there and I've, you know, hand pulled the stuff that I don't want in it, but the clover is just beyond me. I've admitted defeat. And I bought the 30% vinegar, which I've sprayed on it, and it does fantastic. But my question is, when that burr clover dies, what do I replace it with? What's going to come back in its place? What do I need to encourage to come back there instead of the clover?
I would look at a native grass of some sort, and I don't know your native grasses real well. I suspect they're not a lot different from our hill country grasses. There are grasses like curly mesquite. There's some native buffalo grasses, some things that you're not really trying to create a manicured lawn, but you would like to have something that was thick enough to choke out. And I don't know what it is about burr clover this year. I have never, ever seen burr clover as thick as it is this year. And as someone who has a now 19-week-old new golden retriever puppy, we are not looking forward to how often the axle's going to have to get brushed, because these little burrs are just insane this year. But there's a really good seed company here in San Antonio called Douglas King, K-I-N-G, Douglas King Seeds, or sometimes it's abbreviated DK Seeds. I would call Dean Williams, is the fellow who owns the company and an incredibly nice guy, and he will ship to your door. And I would call and ask him, there is a three grass mix that is, they call Habiturf, H-A-B-I-T-U-R-F. It's what they've planted up at the Wildflower Research Center up in Austin. And ask Dean if it would be appropriate for far north Texas like that. If not, I'm sure he could suggest which native grasses would be, you know, most ideal. You're going to have to pray for appropriate rains when you put the seed out. But your best defense is a good offense. You know, if you get the area covered up with good native grasses, you will have far less of the burr clover to deal with. But trust somebody who's been in it their whole life. And like I say, look up Douglas King Seed. If Dean's in, ask to speak to him. And just talk to him about what you are, where you are, what you're trying to accomplish. And if he has a seed blend that will help you, he'll ship it to your door. So much as I'd love to tell you to come to San Antonio and come visit us, you don't have to do that. You get him just to send the seed up to you.
I am there from time to time, but I'd much rather make a phone call. One other question on the, you know, in the same vein. All of the wildflowers that are in the yard are fairly well established now. Mm-hmm. Is there any harm in kind of in for the greater good You know, in some of the spots that I'm going to have to spray the vinegar to get rid of the clover, it's going to take out some of the flowers. If it kills some of them this year, they're probably reseed and be fine and regrow in the spots that I had sprayed the vinegar. Like, that's not long lasting in the soil or anything.
No, it's not long lasting in the soil at all. The other thing that you can do, if you have a source of compost is probably the best natural pre-emergent herbicide. And I've not tried it on burr clover because I've never really seen it as bad as it is this year, but I've totally eliminated the grass burrs and things like that. Putting out compost in the fall, I think the humic acids in the compost serve as natural pre-emergents, and that might be something else that you would consider doing. But also the timing, you know, when you spray, once the burr clover has, you know, started making all of its seed, you have to worry, or you have to ask yourself, is it really worth the effort to spray? Because once it makes its seed for the next season, you're not really accomplishing anything by spraying. The time to get it is very early in the season. So you just have to think about that, whether you really would be better off just tolerating it this year and getting an early start on it next year. And, y'all, of course, you're way north of where we are. You may be cool enough that you can get ahead of the seed production. And if so, no, don't worry about it. If you kill a few of the wildflowers, I'm sure there'll be plenty of them come back next spring. But if your burr clover's already up to the point that it's loaded with seeds, I'm just not sure you're going to accomplish a temporary control, but those seeds are going to germinate and come out next year. So unless you can follow up with a natural pre-emergent like that, I want it to be as effective as possible. And here we are into April. I'm not sure if you're not a little bit late.
It's possible. A lot of it does have flowers on it, and I think it may have some of the little green. The little seeds aren't dried,
yep,
but they're green.
It probably would be worth going after it. But just what I do when I'm spraying in the garden or something like that, I carry a big piece of cardboard. And if I were trying to avoid spraying something, I just, you know, hold up that piece of cardboard between the weed and the thing I'm trying to protect and just spray away. And that way I can get very close to, say, a tomato plant and yet try to kill the Bermuda grass that's grown almost up to it. And just that simple technique will make it easier for you to protect a lot of your wildflowers.
Yeah. Okay. I see a lot of spraying in my future. I appreciate it. The vinegar is awesome, though. I appreciate that tip I heard on your show. It's very satisfying.
Well, get out there and be very religious, walking around saying, let us spray, let us spray, let us spray, and you'll eventually get it under control. That's terrible.
So
you get out and have a...
what I've been saying when I encounter all that clover.
There you go. Well, have a wonderful weekend, and I do appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. Certainly. Bye. Don, I guess it's time to get our last break of the show in and get a little music and come back with maybe time for another call or two.
So I went fishing. Now I think I got a bite. Well, I think we might have got our lines crossed, but the truth is I don't mind. Oh, when you break it down, it's hard to kiss the mouth that chews your ass out all day. So I went fishing, and she's still lying in the bed she made.
Oh, Donna, like you said, that just pushes the envelope a little bit, but I love a good laugh. And as anybody new to the show knows, Mr. Don Cooper Stevens does engineering pretty much every other weekend. And for the last break in the Sunday Garden show, we get a fishing song. And I don't know where you find them all, but that one I'd love to listen to all the way through sometime. Right now, though, let's take a little more time for a little more gardening. It's going to be Tom and E.T., and Tom is up first. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning.
A quick Medina question, okay?
Yeah.
I had sent my wife to pick up some fertilizer for the garden, and I don't get out much anymore because of my age. Anyway, she brought back Bonita has to grow plant. Is that for garden or is that just more for plant?
No, that's definitely it'll work. That's it'll work perfectly. It's what I use. I'm glad she didn't get Medina Grow Lawn, because although it's a great product for the grass, I will admit to having burned the heck out of some tomato plants one time when I thought, I'll see what this does in the garden, and I found out that it is for the lawn. But Hasgrow Plant is outstanding for your garden. Use it every 2 to 4 weeks during the growing season, and it'll give you great results and build your soil at the same time.
Okay. A quick June bug tip, and you've probably done this before, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, I have a front porch light that hangs low,
right,
and below it I have about a 30-gallon trash can with about 4 inches of water in it, and a few drops of Dawn soap, and the June bugs fall in there and drown, and I get several hundred every night. So,
and that is a great tip to be reminded of, and even if you don't have the porch light, I've used one of these little clip-on lights, kind of a little clip-on spotlight, and just clip it to the side of, you've got a big bucket. I've used a 5-gallon bucket, but yeah, they come in and hit that bulb and fall down. And it is important to put that little bit of Dawn or some other dish soap in there, because that's what makes them sink.
I'm catching hundreds of them every night. So, and then I had a personal question. It involves me, but it's a question for you. I'm elderly and I'm having back problems. I was listening to the radio one day, and I thought it was you that said they got a stem cell shot in a joint. Was that you or not?
No, that wasn't me. Knock on wood, I haven't had that problem.
I don't know who it was then, or
it probably was. Oh golly, I don't know if it was.
It was one
probably,
of the local, it was one of the locals.
probably Trey's partner Sean. He seems like the kind of guy that would need that a little bit more often. But
this was a garden. This was a garden show. But anyway,
But I will tell you, Dr. Kirby, veterinarian friend that'll be on here in just another very few minutes. He uses stem cell therapy in animals with joint issues. Backs, knees, things like that. Very, very successful. It's stem cell is the ultimate treatment, less expensive, and the good place to start is what they call PRP, which is protein-rich plasma, which is something they do with their own blood. But
They pull it out of your own blood. No, I just had that. I thought it was you. I'm 85 years old, and I'm starting to have a lot of back problems. So.
Good luck with that, and go see my friend Rhonda for some different things that'll make that back feel a lot better over
time. All right. Well, I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tom.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Let's get E.T. in here before we reach the end of the show. Good morning, E.T.
Morning, Bob. How are you today?
Off to a good start. It's overcast, but a very pleasant temperature out there. A nice day.
Okay. Several real quick questions. A firebush, what's the life expectancy? How long can a firebush last?
10 or 15 years, but the one thing about firebush or Himalaya, as it's properly called, it will always be the last thing to come up. It is the slowest perennial to come back. I tell people it comes back 2 weeks after you give up on it. So don't worry if it's not coming back up yet. It is always the slowest one to come out.
Okay, mine's been in the ground since the 90s, so it's quite a long time. Okay,
yes, sir.
Question, BT. And mosquito dunks. What's the difference between BT and mosquito dunks? The same.
Okay. BT is Bacillus thuringiensis. Mosquito dunks contain Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. It's a special strain of BT that kills larvae of mosquitoes and fungus gnats and things like that. But there are many different forms of BT. One in mosquito dunks is called BTI, which stands for Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis, and that's just a different strain of BT than what you're using to fight caterpillars.
Okay, for that one for caterpillars, a couple of drops in my water catchment thing, will that eliminate mosquitoes?
You probably want to use more than a couple of drops, but yes, it will very definitely eliminate the larvae, and that'll eliminate the adults.
Okay, my strange question for today, it has to do with mistletoe. Can mistletoe be grown in a container, and does it bloom?
It does bloom, not a showy bloom, but it is a parasite. You can't grow it in a container unless you had a tree in a container. which was stretched to the point that mistletoe would grow on the tree. But mistletoe only grows where it's started growing its little tendrils down into the wood of the tree. And I'm going to have to hold you there because we are out of time. Dr. Kirby's next year on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.